You're with Sarah McDonald on ABC Radio.
Well, have you seen the new Spike Lee movie, Black Klansman? Here's a little bit where the main character, Ron, is trying to convince his police partner, Flip, that he should join him in infiltrating the Ku Klux Klan.
I'm not risking my life to prevent some rednecks from lighting a couple sticks on fire.
This is the job. What's your problem?
That's my problem. For you, it's a crusade. For me, it's a job. It's not personal, nor should it be.
Why haven't you bought into this?
Why should I?
Because you're Jewish, brother. The so-called chosen people. You've been passing for a WASP. White Anglo-Saxon Protestant, cherry pie hot dog white boy. That's what some light-skinned black folks do. They pass for white. Doesn't that hatred you've been hearing the Klan say, doesn't that piss you off?
Of course it does.
Then why are you acting like you ain't got skin in the game, brother?
Rookie, that's my business.
It's our business. I'm going to get you your membership card so you can go to the cross burning and get in deeper with these guys.
That's a bit from Black Klansman. Now, the Klan, as you probably know, is a not so secretive anymore, but a once secretive white supremacist society which first emerged in the American South in the mid-1860s. A few months ago on the show, was it months? Can't be months ago, maybe weeks ago, settling into months, we did look at secret societies and we discussed the Knights Templar, the Bilderberg Group and the Masons. But there's so many more to investigate and it's all just so fascinating. We're going back to secret societies and tonight we're going to talk about the Klan, the Odessa Society, Bohemian Grove and maybe more if we've got time. Judy King is with us to discuss these societies. She's a tutor at the WEA in Sydney and she's our guest to revisit this fascinating subject. Hello, Judy. Welcome back.
Thank you and good evening.
We just had too much fun last time. We've just got to come back. So let's go to the Ku Klux Klan, given we've played a little bit of that movie. What are its roots? Where did it come from? And what does this name come from?
Well, the name's from the Greek, kuklos, ku, the kuklos, the circle. And the word clan was added probably for alliteration purposes because so many of the southern heritage in the 19th and 18th centuries was from Scotland. And many of the disaffected southern soldiers after the end of the Civil War were looking for some sort of solidarity because they were so opposed to the freeing of the slaves and to the reconstruction that was happening in the South. So it's a clan circle, and part of the original dressing up was very theatrical, and a lot of it included play acting on stage, old Greek myths and Roman heroic stories, probably because they wanted to relive glories that were no longer available to them.
Well, so is that how they started out?
Yes, they started out play acting on the stage and wearing costumes.
And were they the white gowns?
They became so, but some of the very early photos I found were black and white photos and they described green and dark blue and other colours. But gradually it became white and then the pointed hoods, and all the paraphernalia of knighthood from the Middle Ages and from the old stories seemed to infiltrate these circles of disaffected southern soldiers.
Right. So it came from the South, and the members were just people who were still opposed to the end of slavery and just not adjusting to the new society.
Not adjusting, and they really believed that they had the forces of the economy on their side, because slavery for them was a very economical process.
That's right.
And now they had to adjust to life without slavery. And of course, that was extremely difficult because most of the concentrated industry and employment and investment was in the North.
Yeah, right. So what was its aims and objectives apart from sort of harking back theatrically to ancient Greece?
The whole notion of purity and white supremacy, just as you mentioned, and just as that fabulous film, The Black Klansman, was actually exploring. So Protestantism was first and foremost, an essential ingredient. Their enemies were Catholics and Jews and Mexicans and, of course, Black Americans. And so once you can demonize a group, then you can blame them for anything, and then you become the privileged, exclusive, power-broking group, even though you don't have any power anymore because the North has subsumed that power.
So it was a reaction to a loss of power.
Yes.
A fury, really.
Yes.
What about the Burning Cross? Where did this come from, this insignia?
Now, that's not part of 1866, 67, when Nathan Forrest, who was seemed to be the soldier with the most presence and charisma establishing the group, the actual Burning Crosses don't become part of the Klan until the movie Birth of a Nation in 1915. And that movie, before America entered World War I, was played over and over again by Woodrow Wilson in the White House. He loved the film, and he was a segregationist. And even though he's the only American president to have a PhD, he was absolutely committed to the separation of black and white students at universities and schools. And because that movie portrayed the Burning Crosses in the old tradition of the medieval period, then it became integrated into Klan behaviour. So it was a case, in a way, of real life in the Klan sense imitating the art of that film.
Right, Birth but it had nothing to do with the president. It's just they too were inspired, like him, by this film.
Yes,
yes. But, I mean, why were crosses burnt? That you would think that's against the Protestant beliefs.
Well, it's much debated and a bit shrouded in medieval times, because a burning cross can be used, like in the old vampire legends, to keep evil away from you,
right,
and to illuminate what you're doing. And because the 1920s was a period of lynching Negroes in their hundreds across the southern states, usually done at night, and lots of jokes about low-hanging fruit that was captured in the Billie Holiday song, the burning torches were a way to illuminate dark deeds in forests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so how much of the lynchings were organised by the Ku Klux Klan? Was that part of
Nearly all of them.
They were the main driver,
yes,
of this and period in American history.
There's a few cases in Texas and Louisiana where local law enforcement in the early 1920s handed over Negroes accused of crimes to the Klan and just turned a blind eye to vigilante justice.
And so wearing the hoods, was that because they were recognising that although it was wink, wink, nod, nod, have them, it was technically illegal?
Yes, and yeah. I think it adds to the mystique and probably something that I suppose protects them in a way. They can commit crimes, but at the same time be upright citizens in the community. But all the local communities across the southern states must have known who was in the Klan, yeah, and who wasn't.
Well, in small villages, yes, and, you know, in cities as well, you know,
yes,
you do get that in movies. I know who's behind that mask. You're,
yes,
the local magistrate. I mean, how big did it get, and when was the sort of heyday of the secrecy?
The heyday,
of the Ku Klux Klan,
they think, is 1924, 25, 26, 5 million members. Now, that is a huge number given the population of,
yes,
America at the time.
Yeah.
In the November elections of 1924, when Harding had died and there was a new election, and the Klan actually marched in Washington, mostly with hoods over their faces, for block after block after block, thousands and thousands of Klansmen on the street to say what they wanted from a new president. Quite extraordinary. And after that, it went into abeyance for a while and, of course, wasn't seen much in World War II, but it resurged again significantly in the civil rights movement of the middle 50s and 60s.
As a response to the civil rights movement.
As a response to Martin Luther King, yeah. As a response to Johnson getting the civil rights legislation through through Congress, which Kennedy had not been able to do.
Mm. And how far north did it get?
Virginia, which is not very far from Washington.
Yeah. Well, of course, in Virginia recently,
yes.
We've seen the reincarnation, or is it the same society, just less secretive now? I mean, is there a linear connection between what we're seeing now and then?
Well, there is, but it's problematic to speak of the Klan as one national group, because what it really is hundreds of localised groups that are actually state-based or even city-based or regionally based in the West Virginia or Alabama and Tennessee. It started in Tennessee.
Right.
So each chapter would have varying degrees of fanaticism or how much criminal or thuggery activity they'd
be prepared to. But do they have a core kind of charter they sign up to?
Yes. They certainly subscribe to the same scapegoats and same enemies.
Right.
And in the 2016 election, many Klan chapters endorsed Donald Trump, and he didn't disavow the endorsement.
And they're called, they said, this is the Ku Klux Klan endorsing Donald Trump.
And in fact, David Duke made a reappearance. Yeah. He's just turned 70, and he was thinking of being a candidate in the midterms in November, but I haven't seen his name mentioned anywhere. And he was the former Grand Wizard from the 1960s, and he made a personal appearance on TV to endorse Donald Trump.
Yeah, now why were they called Grand Wizards?
And Grand Cyclops. And this is part, I think, of do you go back to medieval, ancient Greece, ancient Rome, ancient Egypt, paraphernalia, the whole business about blood oaths and knighthoods and exotic tales and titles. But they've certainly retained them.
Incredible, isn't it? I think I've had heard a really interesting story actually about one of the relatives of David Duke who went off to university and disowned his his grandfather, I think it was, his belief. Mm-hmm. So, but he, I mean, what's their current political and social reach? Do we know that they're?
Well, part of the dialogue in the movie, The Black Klansman, was explored in this way, because the black policeman on the other end of the phone that they didn't know was black kept asking them questions. Well, what do you want? And many of the leaders said, in an ideal world, we want every black American to go back to Africa. And then I suppose there'd be all shades of
everything
in between.
Yeah.
So what they want is back to segregation and separation and apartheid.
And they still want that now.
I think so. Several of the high-profile ones do. And that, of course, has been fueled by President Trump's pretty vitriolic demonization of Mexicans and Muslims and migrants.
I feel emboldened by that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And do they have links with the neo-Nazi?
They seem to, because on the streets of Charlottesville in South Carolina, the riots in 2017, and then the year before when there was that great to-do about should we still fly the Confederate flag, that, of course, the Klan often flies, it is its flag or one of its many ones. They were not only displaying the Klan insignias of the various knighthoods, but also the swastika. And they were certainly not hooded. They were wearing hoods, they were off, and they were showing their faces. And it was extremely ugly.
Yeah, so they're not illegal.
No.
But they're not really secret anymore either. As you said, the hoods have come off.
And remember that hate speech in America is not illegal because of
freedom
of speech and the First Amendment. Yeah. So, no, they're not an illegal organisation. And, of course, violence is illegal and threats and intimidation and so on. So they try to, I think, be careful on what's criminal and what they can get away with.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah, and behaviour. All right, you're on Nightlife. We're talking about secret societies. That's the Ku Klux Klan. Judy King is with me. We talked about some others, including the Knights Templar a couple of weeks ago. If you have information or thoughts on any of these or a question, 1300 800 222 is the number to call. Thanks to Barry, who he just wanted to ring to make the point that secret societies often perpetuate elitism by their very secrecy. They are able to exist beneath society and sometimes the law. Would you concur, Judy?
Very much so. Yeah. And sometimes the secrecy is for altruism. Many of the Masonic groups do a huge amount of social work and social support and networking, but they don't mind admitting that they belong to it, and they don't cover their faces. But what they actually do in meetings and what their procedures are and what their statements are and so on is very much kept under wraps.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, which now, didn't Muhammad Ali, someone texted and said Muhammad Ali met with the Klan. That's from Stephen. And apparently he did at some stage. I mean, and told people about it. Was in a documentary. But unbelievable. I don't know if he was trying to convince them to not be part of the Klan, but, I mean, he wasn't scared of a
Well, he a certainly fight. Wasn't afraid of yeah. ever articulating a point of view. He went to jail rather than fulfil the requirements of the draft, and he said that the Viet Cong, he had nothing against them, whereas his own Americans had been extremely racist to him. Yeah. He threw his gold medal into the river when he went back to Louisville.
But why would he meet with the KKK? I mean, apparently it was before he fought Joe Frazier in the Philippines in 75.
Well, it could have been to debate them and take them on.
Yeah.
I mean, he was never afraid to speak his mind and is very articulate.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you want to know more about that, it's in a documentary, apparently. He shared this information and talked about it in True Stories, Thriller in Manila, I think it is. Yeah. It's a television documentary. So, yeah, he had chats with some of the white supremacists of the Ku Klux Klan. Unbelievable. All right, let's go back to another secret society and let's go back to the last stages of World War II for this one. When Germany was defeated by the Allies and surrendered, many high-ranking Nazis had already made arrangements to flee the country. And there's been speculation since that a shadowy organisation existed called the Odessa, which was set up to aid the escape of these men and their families. I think that this was in Fred Forsyth's novel and the film with John Voight, the Odessa Society. So some historians poo-poo the idea of this secret society at all, but there was definitely Nazi collusion with some European governments, wasn't there?
European governments and also different representatives of the Catholic Church
yeah.
and very anti-communist organisation like the Ustasha in Croatia and so on. And while it's not one single organisation, but many different groups, some operating out of Austria, some out of Germany, some out of Italy, some out of Spain, Franco-Spain after the war, it's an acronym. In German, the ODESSA stands for a conglomeration of former SS officers. I can't say it in German.
Is that right?
So the actual initials stand for former SS officers supporting each other post-war.
Right, to get away.
So in many ways you could say that could be benign. It could be to find employment or to resettle or to be part of the resurrection of Germany. But so many of them were facing criminal charges that at least 10,000 of them were able to get false passports and flee to various parts of the world, not entirely South America. Apparently many went to Spain and also to Syria. There was a whole safe house system operating in the Middle East as well.
Right. And we know some who actually got away of these
yes.
in these sort of rat runs too, don't we? And some high-profile Nazis.
Like Eichmann. Yeah. And when Mossad tracked down Eichmann with the help of the Wiesenthal Institute, and they brought him back for trial and then, of course, execution. Mm. They found out a lot more then about the rat lines from documentation and leads that had led them to him. And I brought in tonight a photostat of Eichmann's false passport in the name of Ricardo Clement. And they were able to trace back that many of the false IDs came from Bishop Hudal, an Austrian Catholic bishop who had always been very pro-Hitler and said that Hitler was going to be the saving face of Western civilization against communism.
So they sheltered them and helped them and used church contacts for them to escape and flee.
If you had a letter from a Monsignor or a bishop, it was much easier to travel sometimes for several weeks on the run at safe houses. And then you'd get to the right destination, often Genoa, where a lot of the ships sailed from. You could then get the false passport. But to get that far, you could on the letter from a bishop or a Monsignor.
Yeah. And so what else did they do for them? They helped them escape. They gave them fake passports. They sheltered them.
Finance, I think, is huge. And historians are still trying to unravel it because the Swiss banks refuse to disclose any money they're still holding from Jewish families. They refuse to disclose what they're holding from Nazi art and looted treasures and gold bars and so on. So it seems to be that a lot of the Odessa activities was through Swiss banks and then setting them up in South America or Spain with just a new identity but a new livelihood as well.
But were they sort of a secret society that had their kind of values and a kind of way of thinking and, you know, like a secret handshake, or they were more sort of a...
It was more like a network.
Yeah.
And the idea was to escape prosecution because they'd seen high-ranking Nazis, if they didn't commit suicide, so many were hanged, not only at the Nuremberg trials, because that was the high-ranking Nazis, but hundreds of them had been shot by the Russians without any trial. When they liberated the camps, they actually allowed the prisoners to hack them to death in real vigilante style. Mm. So the urgency to get away was, they didn't mind surrendering to the Americans or to the British, but
not
their
the
biggest fear was if the Russians got hold of them in the camps.
Yeah.
So they're fleeing possible 20-year, 15-year, 10-year jail sentences and incarceration. So the urgency was to get away.
Mm. And so did Simon Wiesenthal and the Nazi hunters manage to stamp out this Odessa network?
Not really, because Wiesenthal died in his early 90s, 2002, I think, in the early 21st century. And, of course, by then most of the Nazis were well into their 80s as well. But they were still unearthing people in the 1980s, like Klaus Barbie, and taking him back to France to stand trial and so on. So while they had a few high-profile arrests and discoveries, many of them escaped, and like Mengele, and they died in South America, and they lived an unencumbered life.
Of freedom.
Yes.
And wealth.
Yes, very much so. And, of course, they had the protection of Perón, the Argentinian dictator. There were about three different times in the late 40s when Eva went to Spain and a little quick trip to Switzerland. No doubt that might have been organising some of the money or the bank accounts. So Eva Perón and Juan Perón in Argentina were very welcoming. And if they didn't go to Argentina, they could go to Paraguay or Uruguay. A few went to Brazil. And then there was also Franco Spain.
Yeah. All right. Now, apparently, back to the KKK, at one point, Muhammad Ali and the KKK agreed black and white should live separately, says Gary from security. And they did appear together on stage, said someone else, agreeing they should segregate. Well, so he was a segregationist.
I'll have to have a look at the documentary on the thriller in Manila then.
That looks fascinating.
Because that is the late 70s, yes.
Yeah, and Ali was he believed in separation.
Well, he was only 18 when he won his gold medal at the Rome Olympics in boxing. And when he came home, he went to the local diner and they refused to admit him because he was black. And that's when he said he went to the bridge and he threw his gold medal, it's probably still there, in the river. And from then on, he was just emboldened and angry and disaffected, as you would expect.
So at one stage he went for segregation, Mandy's saying he wasn't consistent about it, but that may have been one stage when he met with the KKK.
Well, it might have been, but I'm certainly not aware of him advocating segregation, but I'll have to have a look at that documentary.
No, all right. Yeah, well, I think there was some changes of heart along the way. You're on Nightlife on ABC Radio and it is 1:30. My guest is Judy King, who's a lecturer in different historical topics. We're doing secret societies tonight.
Nightlife with Sarah McDonald on ABC Radio.
All right, this next one is a ripper. Has very interesting roots too. In 1872, a special club was set up in California to have a party in a forest to send off an actor who was relocating to the East Coast. The Bohemian Club went on to attract many captains of industry and politicians, including US presidents. And it involves burning your worries and worshipping a giant owl. This is fascinating, Judy. How did this society go from such humble beginnings to what it is now today?
Well, I think probably because the people that threw that party originally in 1872 were a bunch of bored journalists from the San Francisco Chronicle. And they quite liked the idea of going a couple of hundred miles into North California, into the great Redwood Forest, where you can shed your clothes and relax and drink a lot. And then if you change the name of the meeting or the club to Grove and call it Bohemian Grove, you've got this sort of quasi-sacred, spiritual, let's fool around in the forest type ethos.
Well, nude.
Yes, could
be
nude.
They were nude, were they?
Sometimes nude.
Right.
And why the owl? Because it's always been a symbol of wisdom and linked to Minerva from ancient Greece. And on the $1 note, the American note, if you get your magnifying glass out, there's a tiny little owl ensconced in the corner. And the owl appeared in so many things of the foundation of America after the Declaration of Independence and so on, in all of the old Masonic signs. So I think it's got quasi overtones with the Masons in the beginning as well. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's men only. But it's been going since 1872.
But if it was started by a group of journalists, now it's sort of become incredibly powerful members of society.
There's a 15-year waiting list.
To get in?
To get in. It costs you $25,000 to join and you are guaranteed privacy and security and you can partake in this burning of your troubles. And you put all of your cares and woes into a great big coffin and set it on fire in front of the owl. I think you write them down and you leave them there and you can enjoy. Most people stay for the whole 2 weeks and that would be an escape from the burdens and the realities of life itself.
Of a powerful life with so many.
Well, they say that.
To get in, you said there's a 15-year waiting list.
Yes.
But and you have to pay $25,000, but I'm assuming they don't just take anyone.
No, because there's a vetting process and also you can take guests. They say that Saudi princes have been there, Henry Kissinger, Donald Rumsfeld, lots of CIA boffins, generals in the American army. So it really is a global elite if you can bring guests from overseas.
Right. So to get in and to be vetted, you have to be pretty powerful.
Yes.
Rich and powerful.
And their motto is "Weaving spiders come not here," which is a quote from Midsummer Night's Dream. And if you come here, then we will guarantee to protect you, look after you, and secrets will be kept.
Wow. So is there an initiation when you...
Not that I'm aware of.
But who knows? Because it is relatively secret.
It's very hard to get in. Mm. Alex Jones, the Texan conspiracy theorist, got in 2000 with a couple of cameramen. And he was, of course, discovered and ejected. And then he's railed against them ever since. He's also the one that tried to crash the Bilderberg group and get in. He's got a real fondness for trying to crack these secret societies so he can expose them on his very high-rating television program in America. But he certainly was able to film a few things. And there's some old photos from the past. But these days, with drones and helicopters and security, very difficult to get in there. And it's 2,000 acres in the middle of a redwood forest. It's huge.
But are there like cabins or?
Yes, there's lots of cabins.
It's probably pretty five-star glamping. Well, kind of camping in cabins.
Some old photos I saw, they were more like camping in tents.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay. And you've got a great photo we might put up on our website if we can scan it of the giant owl.
The giant owl, 40 foot high, and it's probably not correct to say worship, but they certainly cavort around it and...
Dancing,
yes. Yeah. There's some early photos from the 1920s of Grecian and Roman-type robes, the clan-type robes, but not hoods or anything.
Right.
Yes. So they seem to want to get away from it all and they seem to want to protect their privacy and we don't really know what they're talking about. There are some photos of people on a platform and everyone seated around arena style, paying rapt attention to whoever's speaking.
Right. Now, I saw in House of Cards, of course, when Kevin Spacey's character is the president, he goes and visits to mix with the powerful group. And that's basically representation of...
It was based on Bohemian Grove.
Right.
And once when Richard Nixon admitted that he'd been there, not when he was president, but when he was vice president to Eisenhower in the 1950s, he was very dismissive of it and said it was the gayest thing he'd ever seen. And he laughed and made
they
light
have
of
liked
it.
That.
No, but
is that why Nixon? You see?
Yeah. Well,
all the
I
conspiracy
think,
theorists still say he was set up because he upset the Bohemian Grove.
I think Nixon, because he was a Quaker, even though he's a bit of a disgrace to the Quaker religion,
sure
I think he was probably really conservative and pretty prudish. And he was never really accepted as an elite in the way that others were. Mm-hmm. And he always felt that inferiority.
Right.
So that's probably why he dismissed it.
So do you think that all the presidents have gone to be vetted in the Bohemian Grove?
As far as I could find out from doing the research, the historians claim that every Republican president has been there since 1923. But how do we really know? There's certainly a photo of Gerald Ford in 1977 sitting there, and it's very obviously him when he was president after Nixon. And have all of the others been? Well, Bill Clinton denied it and said, oh, no, that's just Republicans go there. But Alex Jones kept pursuing him and asking him about the ceremony of burning Ukiah's in the coffin, and Clinton got very angry with him and just stormed off and refused to answer. So whether that meant he was caught out or he thought Jones was just being ridiculous, I'm not sure.
Do you think that Trump went before he was elected?
Very possibly. They don't invite or want sitting presidents there because of security reasons. And if you went for 2 weeks, you'd certainly be missed. Although Donald seems to disappear to golf courses
quite a lot into Florida. Maybe he went for a day or two or something. Who would know? Because it's secret, so we don't actually know.
And there's a giant gate with a very long driveway in, shrouded in shrubbery and very high trees. And getting into that gate would be a very difficult thing
to
do.
You have to get your ID checked. Mm. And it's definitely all men.
Men only.
No women have ever infiltrated.
No women. No women in the Masons and none in Bohemian Grove.
Bohemian Grove. Oh, now, this is, you know, If anyone's been to Bohemian Grove and you want to call me, this would be this is the hardest question I've ever asked. Oh, this would be a needle in a haystack. 1300 800 222. We do have American listeners on this show. Wouldn't that be amazing? I'd love to know more. But I think given it's a secret society, it'd be very hard to find out. Is there a belief of God to be a member of this? Do you have to be God-fearing Christian?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Right. It's more...
It's more power-breaking.
It's power-breaking,
and
networking. Political deals, networking.
Yes.
Bit of trading going on.
Yes.
Talking about money, what
you're
to
not,
invest
you're
in.
You're not supposed to talk about government policy, but they seem to think that in the early 1940s that a lot of talk took place about the Manhattan Project and the development of the atomic bomb, and that many of those scientists that were working on the bomb, including European scientists from Nazi Germany after 1945, that they were all part and parcel of going there and doing business, whatever happened.
Okay. All right. Judy King is with us. We're talking about secret societies. It's fascinating, isn't it? Let's finish on Opus Dei. Now, they're a very secret and another very elitist sect within the Catholic Church.
Yes.
And they're often called the Holy Mafia. Now, we spoke about the Da Vinci Code last week, time we did this, didn't we? But that, they're also mentioned in the Dan Brown novel.
Yes.
So who founded Opus Dei?
It was a Spanish Monsignor, Escriva, but not till 1928. So it's a much more recent group than lots of the others that we've looked at, some of them centuries old, like the Knights Templar. But he wanted a group... a special group, elitist in a way, within the Catholic Church that was totally dedicated to God. So he wanted something more than members who go to Mass on Sunday and send their kids to a Catholic school and that's about it.
He wanted much more dedication.
He wanted a full life commitment, whether you were a member of a family or whether you went to live in what would be like boarding houses, separate male and female ones, where you weren't in a cloister. It's not a monastery style. You'd go out to work, but you'd actually live in an Opus Dei house.
Right. So it's sanctioned by the church.
Yes.
And what are the what is the dedication or the entry requirements? Obviously,
well,
you've got to be Catholic, very dedicated to God.
And you can be a Catholic priest as well. So I tried to find if any Australian Catholic priests were openly Opus Dei, and two quite young ones, one from Tarramurra in Sydney and another one from Melbourne in 2015, were accepted into Opus Dei, and when they then return to their parishes, wherever they get allocated to, then they would be openly advertising their parish as an Opus Dei parish. But it's certainly not mainstream. It's a very, very small minority. There's probably about 50,000 across the world and could be a couple of hundred in Sydney. And there's a college at New South Wales Uni, Warrane College, which is the Opus Dei College.
Do they have like a headquarters anywhere in the world or in the Vatican?
Yes, there's a huge building in Lexington Avenue in New York. And they probably not administer, because that would be, there'd be an Australian group, you know, a Spanish group, a French group and so on. Most of them are in Europe or America and not in very many other places. But they certainly do have huge headquarters in New York.
Mm-hmm. Mm. One thing people think when they think Opus Dei is that they beat themselves.
Well, some of them do. They do.
So self-flagellation.
Yes. And certainly the founder, Monsignor Escriva, said that mortification was good for the soul. And that's, of course, the that particular practice was picked up in the Da Vinci Code by the member of supposedly of the Priory of Sion, which is not a real group at all, but certainly sounded as if it were in the novel. But not only self-flagellation, but also wearing the cilice for a couple of hours a week.
What's that?
Where you have a metal circle with spikes in it, and you can pull it tight around your thigh or around your arm. And so the spikes dig into your flesh, and you can do that on a different day from the self-mortification with the whip.
Right. Okay. So it's about feeling pain like it's, Jesus? Or
It's the imitation of the crucifixion.
Christ. Yeah.
The suffering, the physical mortification to honour the suffering of Jesus on the cross.
Right. And are there prominent Catholics in the world who have been a member, who have had big influence on the Catholic Church? And
most of the high-profile ones are bishops from South America and Spain.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And what does the Pope think of them?
Well, he doesn't disavow them, and he's a Jesuit.
Yeah.
And he's the first Jesuit Pope, and he seems to be quite accepting of them because of the fanatical devotion to God. So I guess he's okay about them.
Right. I wonder how much influence they have over the Catholic Church, though. I mean, that's what's interesting, isn't it, given that they're sort of, we don't know that much about them.
Well, one of the high-profile spies in America who sold secrets to the Russians for 20, 25 years before he was discovered, Robert Hansen, an FBI agent, he was Opus Dei, and so was his wife, Bonnie. And
also, women are allowed.
Oh, yes, very much so. And
in, that's the only society we've talked about tonight they're allowed in. Okay.
And the buildings, the dormitory buildings, you would have a women's wing and a men's wing.
Yeah.
But they would certainly meet and socialise. And, of course, married people with children who live at home can belong as well. There's different levels of membership. And the whole notion of paying 10% of your wages, the old medieval tithes, that's part of it as well.
To the church.
To the church. And the ones that live in Opus Dei houses might pay more than that, more than the 10%.
Mm-hmm.
So it's total full-on dedication with lots of prayers as well.
Mm.
But not all of them, I don't think, would practice mortification with the cilice and the whip.
Okay. Yeah, so some of them. Stephen from Sydney rang up. He said he thinks Opus Dei and their influence over the Catholic Church is often really overestimated.
Yes.
They're a tiny percentage.
Yes.
Of
it's
the
a very small percentage, which is probably why the Pope doesn't go there or make much mention of them. But there's many shades of Catholicism across the world, just as there are fanatical members of Islam. Fanatical Protestants, fanatical Catholics, it's a small percentage.
Yeah, but I mean, they're not fanatical in the sense that they don't hurt other people. It's self-pain that the Opus Dei are causing. So
yes.
In that way, perhaps they're harmless if that's what floats your boat.
Yes, but there are a few Opus Dei schools around the world, and some members of Opus Dei, when they were born into it and grew up in it and were sent to Opus Dei schools, they certainly tried to escape. They had to be deprogrammed. And that's why a lot of governments are very suspicious of them
and
think it's a cult, in the same way that Scientology is considered to be a cult in Germany.
But what did they need to be deprogrammed about?
Well, the constant need to sacrifice everything you do to God and the moral judgments about sin.
Uh-huh.
So many sins.
And that's probably how we know a bit more about them, those that have come out.
Yes.
And that's the thing. They didn't, if you're born into it, you're sent to a school like that, you haven't made the choice.
No. And Opus Dei denies vehemently that they pursue people who leave, but that's not what some of the escapees in their 30s and 40s have actually said, that they were pursued, that they were driven out by the obsessiveness of it all, and they suffered quite a lot at the hands of, they said, psychological type of torture.
You're on Nightlife. We've been talking about secret societies. Judy King is with me. Just pop your headphones on, Judy, because Dennis wants to ask you about a society you may have heard about or you might know about. Hi, Dennis.
Hi there. It's a beautiful program. Just a quick bit of humour. In Bohemian Grove, would they play Bohemian Rhapsody?
I don't think so.
Because they weren't poor boys where nobody loves them.
Not at all. However, the reality, in South Africa, there was a society called the Ossovar Brandvach. They were vehemently anti-English, and I know about this because my father was telling me how one of his brothers was in Air Force uniform in World War II and was beaten up to within an inch of his life. Now, the thing is, I don't know if that society still carries on, and I think it was that character who used to ride on the white horse as the leader of the nation in the Afrikaans group. But certainly in World War II and up to and including the time the Nats got into power, they were a very powerful subversive group.
And why was your uncle beaten up by them? Because he was in the English officer uniform?
He was in a South African Air Force uniform.
Right. Oh, gosh.
And they didn't support South Africa going into the war.
To the war.
Yeah.
And do you think, Dennis, that the origins go back to the Boer War?
Probably. Very much, very likely, because when you consider it, that was quite a divisive event. And it despite peace being made, a division existed for a long time.
Well, the concentration camps first reared their head there, didn't they, in terms of the British incarcerating Afrikaans in the most appalling conditions?
Yep.
So I wouldn't be surprised if the origins of that group were from what happened in the concentration camps during the Boer War.
Highly likely, highly likely. I mean, we will only ever hear history as decided by the victor, because those are the people who write the history. If you look at Churchill's words, you never hear the other side of it.
Yeah. So what were they called? Ossovar Brandvach.
Ossovar Brandvach.
Okay. Oh, okay. Right.
I'll tell you one thing that was quite something. I'm going to 1978. My then girlfriend and I had driven up to the Blider River Canyon, and on our way back we got lost. We were following these cars and we got stopped on the road by this path. This roadblock, and the guy said, "What are you doing here?" And brought off a car. So I said, "Well, we're trying to head back to Johannesburg." And he just said to me, "Turn around there and just go. This is not for you guys." And later, about 2 days later, in the Rand Daily Mail, a report of a meeting of that group was made. But I'm glad we didn't go on down the road.
Yeah, you're lucky you were stopped. Thank you for your call. I hope that society's not together anymore.
Oh, it probably isn't.
You wouldn't imagine it is. Yeah. Thanks, Dennis. Thank you very much. And another text from Joe. Have you heard of the Emerita Society? If not, our secret is safe.
The Sacred Heart?
I think Joe's having a bit of a lend. Emerita.
Sacred Heart, I think.
Is it?
Another esoteric Catholic group.
Right. It's not the Mafia.
No. I think it's more the Catholics supporting Franco in the civil war in Spain.
Is that what you mean, Joe? Okay. Thank you so much. I find this is just so interesting because, I mean, I've never sort of been attracted to secret societies, but it's important to know as much about them as we can, because when things are secret, they're not being watched, and they could be getting away with stuff that's just, you know, that is influencing our life. So Judy King has been my guest, and she teaches at WEA. What's your next course on?
Well, at the moment I'm teaching one on all the different Asian countries from 1945 to 1950, so decolonialisation and the shaking off of the European empires of Britain and France and the Dutch, and trying to get themselves together in a new society after World War II.
All right. Well, look up their website because there's great courses for you. You can never stop learning in life. Thanks, Judy.
Thanks so much, Sarah.
We'll speak to you again soon. You're on Nightlife.